Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a game designer and founding chair of New York University's Game Center. An influential writer, speaker, and thinker on video games, he's taught generations of emerging young designers. The New York Times once described him as the reigning genius of the mysteries of games. My guest's experience is not merely academic, however. In 2005, he co-founded Area Code, the studio which subsequently released one of the best-regarded puzzle games yet made, Drop 7. Most recently, he joined forces with his son, who is also a game designer, and together they released Babel Royale, a free-to-play battle royale influenced by the board game Scrabble. Making games combines everything that's hard about building a bridge with everything that's hard about composing an opera, he once said. Games are operas made out of bridges. Welcome, Frank Lance.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So that quotation has become pretty famous. A few years ago, it was used to introduce a video game exhibition at the V&A Museum of Design here in London. Are you still happy to describe video games in that way?
Yeah, I think that captures something of my understanding of what games are, in the sense that I think of them as being works of culture, creative works, aesthetic works, works of art. You know, they have all of those properties of being imaginative expressions of ideas, of creating experience, and all of that quality. While at the same time, having this intense relationship to engineering, to problem solving, to the kind of cognitive work that we do when we are trying to figure out the truth of something, when we're trying to puzzle out the solution to a concrete problem in the world in a kind of practical way. Right. I think it is this relationship to the sort of engineering aspects of bridge building, and then like all of the kind of ineffable and irreducible qualities that go into making art. Now, it's that, like, having said that, look, there's lots of engineering in opera. Just ask anyone who's ever put on an opera and they'll be, yeah, there's problem solving and there's all kinds of like logical, you know, work that goes into practical, pragmatic problem solving that goes into making a work of art. And also, there's less of aesthetics in bridge building and bridge design. You know what I mean? There's like, these are also works of culture that that can be more or less beautiful in addition to having to stand up. But yeah, but I think, that does still, I think, capture a lot of what I think about as sort of the central dynamic of games.
The way, I love the way you describe games. What a great answer. And that, I sort of feel like it captures everything that could be interesting to a human being is somewhere in that mix that you've just laid out there. So why do you think video games aren't interesting to everyone? What are the reasons for that?
Why aren't they more popular? I think part of the answer is that they're mostly terrible. Like, have you tried playing a video game recently, Simon? Like, even people like us who just like full-heartedly devoted our lives to them. Like, I mean, you've got to be honest. And don't you sometimes think, gee, is it too late to get a new hobby? Like, you look around and they still feel like they're like, yeah, kind of like trapped in this like strange kind of like, they got one foot in kids culture still. And they're still kind of like having a hard time kind of growing up a little bit and being less kind of juvenile. And they're also, I don't know. I think they're mostly fine. I'm not a big pessimist. I'm not a person who's like, oh, you know, the mainstream games suck. I think all games are just, they're hard, right? They're hard to interact with. They are more challenging to kind of uncork what's good about them than any other comparable form of culture. They have this kind of built-in challenge, which makes, even though that they are universal in a sense, right? If you, like I do, if you think of video games as part of the broad spectrum of games in play, then you start to understand, okay, well, this is kind of universal. We all pretty much play, you know, and have an element of games in play in our lives. But even then, some people are drawn more to it and some people are not. Some people are naturally drawn to wordplay, to playful social interaction, to imaginative kind of responses, unpredictable responses to situations. And then some people are not. And so I think that makes a lot of sense. Hey. And then when it comes to video games in particular, video games are still very firmly part of the domain of computers and software. And computers are still devices for hobbyists.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Like getting a game to run on your computer is just an ordinary game to run on your computer is still a kind of complicated process of like figuring out a technical puzzle. Right. It is something that you have to have an appetite for. You have to have an appetite for like, oh, I need to update my drivers and make sure that I'm in the right resolution mode. And do I have enough RAM? And maybe I'm on some earlier version of the operating system and I need to, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's to their credit, honestly, that computers are still like this, that computers have not evolved into refrigerators. Or rather, they did evolve into refrigerators, and those are called phones.
Right, right.
Right? Computers evolved into, they finally got to a point where just everyone uses them. No one knows how to maintain a fridge. Like, you're not, you and I aren't in the back, like,
no.
Unscrewing the Freon right, right. pipes.
Updating the RAM.
Right. But we are doing that with our computers, right? And for that nature, for those reasons, I think computers really still have kept this kind of hobbyist mentality, where you already, by the time you get around to playing whatever game, you've already kind of indicated that you have a certain appetite for technical problem solving. And then when you get into it, when you get into Destiny or whatever you're playing, that it's that same flavor. Like, you're doing a similar thing. Like, you're running around getting just the right kind of like tech, trying to find the right technical solution. Wait a minute, what is this quest? And how do I do this other thing? And it's like, oh yeah, you got to read the details and figure out how it all fits together. And you're kind of like figuring out how the gears fit together. And you're puzzling it out. And it's similar to maintaining a computer in the first place. So I think that's part of the answer, but they're doing fine. I mean, it's not like,
yeah, right.
I mean, they're not like, Like, if you think about what truly is universal and global, it's like hip hop, right? Hip hop is like, is that something where, like, pop music in general, and in particular, hip hop, I think you just see how it has some kind of like magic ability to get translated into different cultures and adopted by different communities and people all over the planet in a way that is really fluid. Whereas I think games, you know, they don't have that. But I mean, if you look at soccer, I mean, soccer is like that, right? And soccer is a game.
Yeah.
And it's not that different from, you know, Rocket League or something. You know, Rocket League is just soccer where you have to, you know, install RAM.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, Frank, this is going to be a lot of fun, I can tell. So the premise of the podcast is I've asked you to pick the five video games you want to install on your ideal video game machine, sort of like a Super Nintendo Mini or something like that. And yeah, can you tell us about the first game you've picked, which is from 1995? Can you tell us what the game is and when you first experienced it and why you love it?
Oh, of course, Wipeout. So Wipeout, first of all, I love this project. I think it's interesting and it's like in a weird way, it's harder to pick five than it is to pick one. You pick one, it's like, oh, it's your favorite game. And you're like, well, it doesn't really matter because it's so artificial. But then you widen the scope a little bit and say, okay, what are five great games? Then you kind of want to like dig in a little bit and treat it more seriously. At first I thought, like, should I interpret this question as, you know, really thinking about what would be the form factor of a device. Like, if I was on a desert island and I had, is it a handheld device? Does it have a screen? Is there a keyboard and mouse, or is it touch in it? And I gave up because I thought, okay, that's too hard. I don't want to try to like engineer some imaginary device and then figure out what are the games that I love that I would want to be on there. And instead I interpreted it as just being, look, pick five games that you would want to play, games that mean something to you, that are really important, but also that you would genuinely want to play. So,
right.
This first one, Wipeout, is a game that really means a lot to me. I think it was one of the big inspirations in my life and in my career. I'd moved to New York City. I was starting to make. Working at a place that did computer graphics and special effects, but I was doing like Photoshop stuff and
for like movies or for video games or
it's a place called RGA and they did special effects for film and they did title sequences, and they were starting to get into doing image processing. That's what I was working on, like large scale, like Photoshop, you know, kind of image manipulation, but then also, because that introduced Max into the picture, they were starting to say, oh, maybe we should start developing software. So I was kind of helping found the interactive division within this context, right? And so during that time, right around that era, so what is this again? Tell me that in 1995, right. We got a demo disc of the first Wipeout. And we played that thing so much. And the demo, it was just like a single track. And as you know, Wipeout, right, Simon? I mean, you know the beauty of this game.
Futuristic racing game.
Yeah, futuristic maglev racing. We played that first track over and over and over again. And we would sit around, a bunch of us. And if you crossed the finish line, it reset the game. And then you would have to like choose the race. If you won, they would like reset. But if you didn't, if you just canceled, then you could just instantly restart the race.
Oh, because it was a demo disc, you mean?
Yeah, like if you finished the race, it would be like, oh, okay, congratulations.
You finished the demo, right.
It would just cause you to have to go back to the main menu and restart again, which took like a minute or, you know, 45 seconds or something.
Right.
So you were not allowed to cross the finish line because the next person was waiting to go. So when you got to the finish line, you had to like wipe out. You had to literally wipe out and like crash into the stands and then cancel. So you were trying to race and try to win, but then you were not allowed to finish the race.
Right.
Because you had to cancel and restart because that was a faster way to get back into the loop. That's how sick we were to like just keep the flow going. There was the thing about Wipeout for me was this was the first video game that felt like an album. This felt like teenage culture. This didn't feel like culture for 10-year-olds. This felt like culture for 18-year-olds.
Yes.
It was at the height of the rave scene, and it had this amazing soundtrack that was, you know, the Prodigy and the Chemical Brothers and all these amazing kind of rave groups. The graphic design was by this studio called Designers Republic, which did all kinds of like album covers, like techno album covers and rave graphics. And the way that that played into the world building of this science fiction scenario and just the overall sense of like pop culture, like this is a work of pop culture, not a work of kids culture, a work of pop culture. And I mean, I just loved it for the experience of it. But in addition, this idea that like, oh, games can be sophisticated, cool pop culture in the way that albums are, that was it for me. I was like, this is the kind of thing I want to make. Like, this is clearly how I want to spend the rest of my life.
Especially such good timing working at a company like you were at where, you know, right at that moment where the PlayStation is coming out and it feels like it's the cusp of a new thing, 3D graphics coming along, and you're looking for, I suppose, you know, more mature, perhaps, expressions of what a video game could be. And then along comes this game that encapsulates all of that. Like you say, the Designers Republic had designed all of the team logos and everything, and it just looked like nothing before, did it?
And the interface was also influenced by that.
Yes.
And so it had this like super flat kind of poppy, like oh, it's just gorgeous and beautiful and fun in a way that is still ahead of its time.
Yeah.
It's still, most games don't, like, it's still rare for a game to come along and kind of feel like cool teenage pop culture instead of like, you know, like a, you know, a dorky van painting come to life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which I love. Yeah. I mean, I love Frank Frazetta and I love paintings on the sides of vans. I love heavy metal and good, you know, good cartoons and good kids culture are fine. I've got nothing against them, but I do. Yeah. I really still hanker after that kind of, slightly more sophisticated vibe that Wipeout had.
It's just a different tradition, isn't it? Because a lot of that heavy metal stuff comes through in Dungeons and Dragons, which influences fantasy and blah, 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 which has always been part of computer games. Whereas here you had Sony really at its most disruptive entering a territory that it really had no place being and suddenly can come in and do a completely different, I mean, I know it's a bit different in the UK to the US, but certainly in the UK, the marketing of around Wipeout was so different. A completely different audience they were trying to hit.
Well, it worked on me, Simon. and so then in addition to just having that kind of like important milestone for me personally, I also think that those early Wipeout games are incredibly playable. So you put that on my console, I'm happy to just like go back and I think that's, it's an example of the type of game that you can play over and over again, build your skills, get deeper and deeper into it, discover, you know, new techniques, and really, it's just got a wealth of play in it. So I think it's a good choice for that reason as well.
So I just want to go back a little bit earlier than this time of your life, because, you know, this is obviously the moment at which you're converted to the idea of video games and what they can achieve, but had they been a part of your life as a younger person when you were growing up?
I mean, sure, like, going to the arcade was a big part of my teenage years. And before that, we had like an early console. I think we had like a Pong machine that you buy at Sears, the big yellow one, or like an Atari. I don't remember exactly, but, you know, we played that and I really liked it.
Where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in the Midwest, Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay.
And then moved out to the East Coast when I was like a teenager.
What did your parents do, by the way?
Oh, they're both actors, actually.
Oh, okay.
My dad was an actor and a voiceover guy. They're both in the theater. And my mom is, also does like performance and acting and singing and stuff like that. So I kind of a theater kid.
Okay.
But then after, like, also, like, prior to this, prior to me being in New York and working at this thing and encountering Wipeout, I had also, I mean, I'd already been bit a little bit by the bug by playing things, like, just by playing early computer games, like Lode Runner. Like, I had a friend who worked in a computer lab, and he would bring this ancient Compaq portable computer. It's called a portable computer, but it's like a big, giant bucket, and right. had a tiny little amber screen on it. And we would stay up late and we'd play Lode Runner, but he also had like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that early adventure game. So playing Zork, playing Hitchhiker's Guide, I think playing Hitchhiker's Guide was maybe the first time that I was like, okay, maybe this is what I want to do with my life. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. like the magic of that, of there being this little bit of interactive literature, because I was really big into science fiction and fantasy, and so having this kind of living story that you could interact with, it just the magic of software. So I think I was already being drawn into that world by those kinds of early PC games.
And was that your, you know, what did you want to do when you were a kid, when you grew up?
Originally I wanted to be a cartoonist. And then when I went to college, I was going to do acting, and so I actually got a scholarship at University of Maryland to go and be in the theater department. But then I realized like a year in, I was like, I don't really like acting. Like, I don't want to do it. Like, and I was really getting into painting. So I was hanging out with all my art friends at the Art Soch building. And
did you feel pressure to go into acting because of your parents then?
No, I just liked it. I mean, I just assumed I was going to do it because I was into it and I enjoyed it. And
I guess you've been around
but
it.
But I think once you get to college, you know, the whole point of college is like you're sorting shit out. You're trying to figure out, okay, what is it that I want to do? And so I think it was just, I think it was just I was, you know, really excited about just trying to imagine what I might want to do in the world. And so I realized, and also, look, I think part of this was just a mistake. Because in my head, actors aren't interesting because they're not making the stuff. Like, they're just interpreting the stuff. They're maybe if I was a playwright or a director, I would be interested in theater. But the idea of just like memorizing words and then going on stage and performing them, like, that's not the interesting part. I want to be the kind of person who makes the thing and who is coming up with the original idea. I think in retrospect, that was both very arrogant. It's kind of the arrogance of youth where you're like, you know what I mean? Like, I need to be the person at the center of, you know, but also a misunderstanding of how much creativity there is in acting. I think actually good actors are creating something original and solving really interesting problems. But anyway, that was what was in my head at the time. And it really drove me towards doing art. So, but at the same time, I was really into computers. Like I said, I was big into science fiction, and I was also really influenced by this book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, by Douglas Hofstadter. It's an early book about artificial intelligence. And so like math and puzzles, I was terrible at math, but I was really into computers. Even in my art, it was already very procedural and conceptual. And so then eventually I tried to like bring those things together and started doing computer graphics and started trying to like write software that generated paintings and, you know, things like that. And that's kind of like drew me into the orbit of making digital stuff. And then eventually it became clear that games were where that was happening. Like if you try to understand the overlap between art and computers, it is games. Like games are the exploration of interactivity as an art form, right? As something creative and expressive and imaginative. And so, yeah, like it was a natural fit for me to really be drawn into that.
Okay, we'll pick that story up again in a minute, but let's turn to your second game for your Perfect Console, which is, I think, a Game Boy Advance game from 2006. Can you tell us what it is?
Rhythm Tengoku. I include this one because it might be my favorite video game. If you held a gun to my head and made me pick, you know, I'm a man of simple tastes, Simon. You know what I mean?
I don't think that's true.
I like good video games. I like Shadow of the Colossus. You know what I mean? Like, I like I like Doom. I, you know what I mean? I like the big ones. But there is something about Rhythm Tengoku, which is this early rhythm action game that has a kind of WarioWare structure, in that it's lots of little games, each one of which has its own mechanic, each one of which is an exploration of interactivity and music. And there's something really magical about the game. It is a game, I think, that has an incredible amount of personality and charm. You really feel the spirit of the people who made it, and it's very original, and it has, I think, just this, it's deeply satisfying.
Yeah.
I think in a way that is hard to put into words. These little tiny cartoons. It's also a game that is perfectly suited to the platform on which it was launched, which I think was the GBA.
I think so, right?
And so yeah. It just, I have this in my head. It's just like this perfect little miniature masterpiece. I'll give you one example. There's one mini game in Rhythm Tengoku that's a little ghost who's sneaking past a gate. And the way the mechanic in this particular mini game works is they play a little song and you're pushing the button along to the song. And then over time, the song fades down and gets quieter and quieter until you have to push the button in rhythm to the song, and it's only playing in your head. The song is no longer playing. I'm getting goosebumps just describing it. and it's a ghost. Like, the whole point of it is that there's this, in the background, there's this minimalist cartoon of, in the background, there's a little suburban house, and then made of a few lines. And then there's the fence, and then there's the little ghost who sneaks. There's a little ghost to sneak it past, and the song just gets quieter and quieter, and it's just, it's so beautiful. It's so mysterious and sweet and beautiful.
Yeah.
I just absolutely love it. And there's a ton of things. So in addition to having these little like gems, these lovely little moments, the overall structure of Rhythm Tengoku is also great. It's there. All of the little games are organized in these different ways, and you're trying to get them all done, and you're like jumping around to different levels, completing them. There's this really satisfying sense of exploring the overall space of possibilities, and that they had fun designing, and now you're having fun mastering as a player. I think I'm mostly drawn as a player, mostly drawn to thinking games. I'm mostly a kind of strategy person. I really like games about decision making, and you know what I mean, that whole thing. But ironically, like, yeah, this might be my absolute favorite game. And it's not a game of strategy, right? This is not a game that you're discovering new emergent properties of the system, and the rules are producing all kinds of unexpected, surprising, you know, interactions. It's like, no, this is content, as we say nowadays.
There's no room for the designer to hide in these games as well, particularly WarioWare and Rhythm Tengoku. They're so brutal. You have to have such clarity of thought about your design idea for it to work, for it to communicate instantly to the player what it is they've got to do, for it to be pleasing. There's usually a little joke in there. It's doing so much with so little so quickly. And actually, there's very few studios, I think, that can pull it off with that elegance, because you see when other companies try and do sort of mini game, micro game collections, they're often never quite as good, are they? But
it's really true. And I love it. And that precision that you're describing is part of the overall aesthetic. It's a perfect fit for the GBA itself, which feels like this lovely little clockwork device that you're holding in, that feels magic, and just the clarity of just the amount of pixels that you have to work with. So the whole thing just like fits together. And it means that this imaginary console that you're asking me to make has to contain that somehow. I'm not sure how to contain it, but it's going to have maybe just a whole separate module just for playing Rhythm Tengoku. So
you're designing a Wii U here.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So I want to come to the part of your career when you come to form Area Code. So by that time, I guess you'd moved fully into working with video games, and you'd been director of design at a company called Game Lab. What was it? Can you just tell us what was going on in your life at that time? And what made you make the jump to set up your own company?
So this was New York in the 90s, and there just wasn't that much in terms of the game industry. And so we had a lot of like little startups, like we had a lot of kind of like indie game studios before that was very popular, just because we didn't have big AAA studios really in New York. So there were lots of little things happening. Flash games were big, and people kind of had to figure out how to make a career outside of the kind of traditional structure of a AAA environment and economy. And so you would do stuff like work for hire, or you'd do flash games. You'd make, you know, free flash games for Lego or for Cartoon Network and things like that. Try to work, you know, find ways of maybe educational games and stuff like that. And so that was kind of the overall landscape that I was operating in and doing, working for a bunch of different studios and mostly for Game Lab. And then at the same time, I was doing big experimental work because I was really interested still in exploring the possibility of new kinds of games, like rather than just trying to make things that fit into the existing framework of, you know, the games market. I was just like, what can you do with games as a form that no one's ever done before? So I was really interested in large scale games that people play face to face in real time, designing games for like conference settings where hundreds of people or thousands of people would play a game over the course of a couple of days, or designing games that people would play on the street running around that incorporated computers and software, but that weren't designed to be played on a computer. But we're trying to find a blend between the complexity you get from having software in the game.
Is that when you made the Pac-Man game in New York? The live-action Pac-Man game?
Yeah, exactly. Like Pac-Manhattan, which was, I was teaching a class in this. It's what they call Big Games. And as their final project, all the students in the class got together and made Pac-Manhattan, which was a version of Pac-Man that you play running around on the street grid of Manhattan. And things like that is exactly what I was really interested. The big urban game, which I did in collaboration with some other folks. And so I was doing these bigger experimental kind of location-based things. That's how I met my co-founder of Area Code, Kevin Slavin, who was kind of aware of these things. And he was coming out of a background in advertising. And he was saying, hey, maybe we could start a company that makes these kinds of games as an alternative to traditional like marketing and advertising. Like you make these things, they generate a lot of interest. You get them sponsored by a technology company or something like that. And so that was kind of the roots of Area Code.
It's such a good name for a company doing that sort of work as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Kevin Slavin, Area/Code, which is, you know what I mean? The blend between the real and the physical and then the virtual and software. But the thing that I was really interested in is I love computers, I love software, but it felt like in the transition to becoming software, games had left something behind, which was the social component. Like games, up until computer games, games are primarily a kind of stylized form of social interaction. Like when we play chess together, we are doing this like strangely intimate cognitive dance where your mind is making up a puzzle for my mind to make up a puzzle for your mind, and I'm responding to each other. And or if you think of sports and, you know, board games and card games, there's so much psychology, there's so much drama in, oh, I'm going to measure my problem-solving ability against yours and we're going to compete. But at the same time, we're kind of collaborating to make something complex and interesting. And in a single-player video game, all of that gets kind of shorn away.
Oof.
And then gets replaced with a cartoon of a plumber who's trying to rescue a princess from a monkey. You know, and... Wait, is that how the story goes? I'm not sure if that's how the story goes. I'm not a big story guy. So I was really interested. Oh, can we bring some of that back, right? It's like the return of the repressed, you know? This is so much of the juice. Like, otherwise games are just math problems.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But like games are math problems with tons of drama in them.
Good.
I don't know. They're like ways of testing your patience and your cleverness and your ability to observe and sometimes your strength, your speed, and like all of these different qualities, and or to like work with other people to kind of cooperate and collaborate and on a team and have these big dramatic, kind of exciting, suspenseful things that we share, and for that to be turned into like a thing you do in a dark room by yourself with a machine. There's a beauty to it. Like, I don't deny that there's something particularly beautiful about that version of games, that just you and the machine and this imaginary world. They are a kind of a new form of literature or whatever. But I was really interested in like, oh, could we kind of have both, right? Can you get the computers, the complexity, the software, the virtual space, the imaginative virtuality, and the bodies, the face-to-face interaction, the excitement and the psychology and drama that it's like these are humans together in a space doing a thing together.
Yeah.
And so that was really what drove Area Code.
Made it happen. But how did you get from that then, which is, you know, obviously about quite physical, yeah, interactive games between people, to then, you know, this very elegant, concise puzzle game,
yeah,
Drop 7, that really is what makes you famous around the world, I suppose.
Oh, my God. Do you know? Well, only in England. Unfortunately, Simon, I wish the rest of the world loved Drop 7 as much
really?
As English people.
I didn't know that.
British people, yeah, British people think Drop 7 is like Tetris.
Yeah, it's like Tetris
and
2.
And most people outside of the Emerald Isle have never heard of it.
Okay.
But bless you. I'm so happy. Look, I'll give you an abbreviated version of the story. We were approached to do an alternate reality game for the TV show Numbers. It was a CBS TV show about a mathematical genius who solves crimes. And we were aware of ARGs. This was during the kind of height of ARG popularity, which meant like 50 people, you know, played them. but it was like I Love Bees,
yep,
you know, all of those famous ARGs, you know, had happened recently. And we knew that we were working in a space that was similar, because ARGs are also about large-scale collaboration, and so they're very social, they're about people working together. But we had always been a little bit skeptical of ARGs, because they're one of those games that everyone loves the sound of them. Like, that's why people read about ARGs on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Oh my God, this is a new kind of game that blends reality and fiction. It
yes.
blurs the line between the virtual and the real and blah, blah, blah. But no one actually plays them. Like, everyone like knows about them and loves them. Like, David Fincher loved the ideas of it. He made this whole movie about them. And so they have such a large space of people's imagination, but very few people actually play them because they're almost unplayable.
Yeah.
Like, if you find out about an ARG and you're like, oh, I'd like to check that out, what are you supposed to do? You go to the website and it's like, wait a minute, is this over? Did it happen already?
Or
I'm not supposed to know, because it's supposed to be confusing. So you puzzle it out, you try to figure it out, you finally figure out, okay, there's some puzzle here or something. And then it turns out, yeah, no, it's been over for 2 years. Like, there's no idea. Like, it's just, you know what I mean? It's such a confusing, opaque, off-putting thing.
Right.
That it is, there's like a handful of like hardcore fans who do them. So we said, okay, we're going to do an ARG, but we're going to solve this puzzle. This is a design problem. We're going to embrace the design problem. And so we decided we're going to make an ARG about an evil genius game designer who's going to be featured in an episode of the TV show. He's going to make this game that looks like a simple puzzle game. It looks like a PopCap game, but it's actually secretly this plot to addict people to doing this mathematical, this big mathematical problem solving, this like distributed calculation.
Right.
That looks like a game, but really what we're doing is crunching this enormous calculation as if it were a citizen science project. And what that calculation is going to break the encryption by which the stock market protects its operations, and he's going to bring down the whole world economy. Like that was the plot.
Mm-hmm.
But at the heart of this story, we're going to make a little fictional game, and it's going to be like a very simple, accessible puzzle game, and that's going to be your window into this alternate reality game. So that was our idea, and so we made a little abstract puzzle game. We called it Chain Factor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the name of the ARG. It was called Chain Factor. And it kind of worked. Like, it was genuinely, like, there were, like, tons of people played this little abstract puzzle game. And then it would crash and produce these little, clues. And most people ignored that. But some people realized, oh, there's something going on here.
Right.
And that became the rabbit hole. And then there was a whole real-world component of people going around and finding these billboards and posters and TV commercials and decrypting them and figuring it out. And then that fed back into the puzzle game. So it was a very complex kind of multi-layered structure where we wanted to have both of these things happening, the kind of Sherlock Holmes people who are solving the ARG and just the regular ham and eggers who are playing
the
simple puzzle game.
Yeah.
So it kind of worked great. It really was very popular. The puzzle game aspect of it really took off. People love Chain Factor.
Yeah.
And so when the whole ARG had run its course and had reached its conclusion, we were like, well, what are we going to do with this puzzle game now? Are we just going to shut it down? And we said, no, let's actually make a simpler version of it that doesn't have the ARG hooks. That's just the core gameplay, and release it as an iPhone game. This is early days of the iPhone.
Yeah, I remember.
And we thought this will be a fun experiment. We'll see if it works. So that's the origin of Drop 7. It started out as this big cross-media, alternate reality game, collaborative. And it still has traces of that. Like, there's still something, I think, part of the weirdness of Drop 7. Like, it's an unusual game. Like, what, like, the different modes, like, the mode that's the same seed over and over again. It's like the fact that there is a kind of mathy quality to it, that it's not quite as accessible as a standard cute puzzle game, that you have to kind of wrap your head around this unusual kind of mathematical relationship at the heart of the game.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the legacy
of its origin.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Okay, let's come to your third game, which is from, I guess, around the time that this is all happening or shortly after, maybe 2008. Can you tell us about this game? What is it and why do you love it?
Oh, Galcon. Galcon is a little game that almost no one's heard of. It is a real-time strategy game that's rather abstract. It's played on the iPhone, and it is one of these games. There's like a genre of games where you have a network of planets and you're sending ships from one planet to another. Spaceward Ho was an early Mac version of this. This is like that, only real time and very small and abstract. So these little triangle fleets of these ships that are represented as triangles going from one planet to another. And it's just numerical. Like if you hit, you know, if a planet has a value of 80 and you hit it with, you know, 86 ships, you capture that planet and it becomes your color. And now planets that are your color are producing ships over time. And so it's a very, very simple, abstract, real-time strategy game. And this was a game that, I don't know, occasionally you just find a game that fits into your life, into your head. I'm including it partly because it's one of the only games, or maybe the only game I've ever played, that has even a moderately serious competitive scene at which I was genuinely world class.
Nice.
So for there's a giant, you know, it's like, it, you know, it's like, it's weird. Like if you look at people who play, if you look at streamers, for example, who play something like Hearthstone Battlegrounds, right? There's like a handful of them and they're competing to be the best. And what it mostly takes is you have to be good at the game, but you also have to be really dedicated to grind it out, right? And I had a little tiny version of that with Galcon, where I was just playing it for hours a day. I wasn't streaming. I was just, you know, avoiding life, you know, what you do when you play a video game. But I got so deep into it. It is such a miniature masterpiece. Like there's nothing extra. It is just the bare bones of this one little kind of cognitive problem. And I got really deep into it and ended up, for a brief window, being maybe being among the best, if not the best, maybe briefly the best in the world at this game.
You can say it, Frank.
Thank you. I will say it. I'm proud of that. And it's kind of there on the list to kind of remind me that such a thing is possible. But I would say that there's one particular quality that I loved about Galcon that made it the one for me, which is you can play Galcon 1v1, but the kind of standard way of playing Galcon is in these groups of three or four players. And in a group of three or four players, Galcon instantly becomes a very hard problem of the type we call kingmaker. Hey. Do you know what a kingmaker problem is?
I'm not sure.
In a strategy game, kingmaking is when, by my action, I can determine who wins.
I see.
If I'm a player, we have a three-player game, A, B, and C. If C can make an action that determines which of the two players, A or B, is going to win, that's kingmaking.
Yeah.
Because it is gross, because you're like, oh, well, like, why did I bother? Like, the outcome of the game was determined arbitrarily. Like, it didn't matter whether A or B was what choices they made. It's kind of a known problem in strategy games. But the funny thing about what Galcon demonstrates is the power of short sessions. So, like, in the same way that, imagine that a hand of poker took an hour to play. What a dumb game. Can you imagine a dumb game? You're sitting there with seven deuce for an hour, and then at the end, it's like, well, I had seven deuce, so I lost. It's like, a hand of poker is stupid. Like, it's mostly determined by which random cards you got. What a dumb game. Well, guess what? Because it only takes 30 seconds, it becomes not a dumb game, but one of the greatest games of all time.
Right, right.
Because you play 1,000 hands of poker in a night, and the beauty of poker emerges over the course of 1,000 games, 1,000 hands, 1,000 sessions. These larger statistical patterns emerge, and that's where the beauty of poker resides. Galcon, in addition to being this tiny little, like, micro real-time strategy game that required you to, like, be calculating rapidly and moving around, it also was this deep psychological problem. Because when you attacked someone, like, the natural equilibrium in Galcon is for no one to attack anyone. So we're all in this little tiny room on this iPhone screen. And if you attack someone, you are basically making a mistake and you are doing them wrong.
Correct.
You are harming them because you're just helping the other two guys. Like, if players C and D attack each other, then the winner is going to be either A or B, right? So that's kind of the default setting. And you would think, oh, the game can't survive that. But again, because of the short, these games only last for a minute. And so you're kind of like, you're in the same room with the same players right. Over and over again.
What happened three goes again?
Yeah, like, yeah. You can punish people. Like, if you do that, you can punish someone the next game for making a mistake. And so what happens is you've got these norms that emerged about when it's okay to attack, like what is acceptable. Because everyone kind of like intuitively recognized that the game must go on. Like, you can't just like sit in that equilibrium forever. And I became good not just at the math and the micromanagement, but at this larger psychological game. Like, I understood where everyone was in a room. I felt like I had a really good understanding of where the psychological landscape was. I felt like a Machiavellian kind of operator in this space, where I could kind of predict how players would respond psychologically, morally, ethically, to the kinds of things that were happening in a room and in a session. And so just like in poker, where that element of psychology becomes an important part of being a winning player, I felt like that was a kind of hidden dimension of this game that you would never expect.
Yeah.
It just looked like the most dry, abstract game in the world, but it was so dramatic and psychologically
fantastic,
twisted.
Amazing. I spoke to Henk Rogers recently, the Tetris guy, and he picked Spacewood Ho, actually, for one of his games. So,
Oh, that's brilliant. Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. Oh, this is a nice little thread then.
Nice little thread, because those
games are deeply connected. Deeply connected, yeah.
Okay, I just want to quickly come back. So you've got this hit iPhone game on your hands, Drop 7, that was never intended to be a standalone iPhone game, but it is. And then it results in, well, Zynga, this, which was at the time was a very, very successful publisher of online games and phone games and Facebook games and things like that, comes in and they buy, did they buy the game or do they buy Area Code?
Oh, yeah, they did. They bought Area Code. They couldn't care less about Drop 7.
Oh, they didn't, right, yeah.
Yeah, no, that Drop 7 was just like, if I had really pushed for it, I probably could have carved Drop 7 off as its own thing. They would not have cared one way or the other. Because they were Zynga. They knew how to make hit games. This Farmville. They were interested in us because we, by then, had started making Facebook games. And we had a couple of early big hits on Facebook, Parking Wars and a couple of other games. And so we were approaching Facebook the same way that we approached, like, the street. Like, okay, this is a place you can make games that involve people interacting with each other. The social dimension of it was really interesting to us. Yeah, so we had started to like figure out, oh, look, these social games might be really interesting and cool. I mean, it turned out that they weren't that interesting and cool, I think, in retrospect.
Right, yeah.
Like, but at the time, you didn't know.
You didn't know.
And so when we had, like, when Zynga wanted to acquire us, it just kind of made sense financially. It looked like, okay, wow, this is kind of like peak. Like, this is like, we're probably worth more now than we ever will be. And
sure. So
we should probably seize this opportunity. And it's a good way for, I didn't really want to, like, I like making games, but I don't really love running a business. And I didn't really want to run a business for the rest of my life. And so I thought, this is the perfect timing for this.
Yeah.
And it just means having to get in bed with Zynga for a little bit. And maybe I can figure that. And we thought, so at the time, we were going to be like a kind of R&D studio within Zynga, doing original games and trying to see if we could come up with something genuinely good on Facebook that wasn't just, you know, that wasn't just an exploitative, habit-forming, time-on-device, manipulative kind of thing, but was genuinely kind of like an original, fun, cool, interesting game.
Yeah.
And so that's what we tried to do. It didn't really work out. We came up with a game idea called the Friend Game, which I think if Zynga had been really behind it, might have been really fun. And it was a little bit inspired by a game that professional poker players play called What Does Johnny Lawton Think? Johnny Lawton is this random poker guy. But they used to, when they're sitting around a table, they would ask someone, okay, how high in feet do you think the Empire State Building is? Don't say the answer, just lock it in your head. And then two other people would guess about that. So you're not guessing about, like, you're betting not on how high the Empire State Building is, but on how high Johnny Lawton thinks it is.
Right, right.
And so we made a game on Facebook that was about, like, guessing what your friends would say in answer to different questions.
Yeah, that's a great
about
idea.
What their favorite sport is, or like what they would do in this social situation. It's just a very much of a party game, kind of a social party game but it really never saw the light of day. It wasn't the kind of thing that fit into Zynga's strategy.
It's funny, those sort of experimental games you're describing there. There was just a time where it felt like there were so many of those experiments happening, and now it just feels like a really lost world. None of that seems to be going on anymore in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it really, it's surprising, and maybe it will come back, but it really, it turned out to not be as, this kind of promise that I felt that I was hoping would happen on Facebook games and things like that just kind of petered out. There wasn't a lot there.
Should we come to your fourth game?
Sure. I think it's Syncopaus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Samit, you've said that you haven't played Think Up House
yet. I have not, no.
Okay, good. So I'm happy to introduce you to this, and I think that if you give it a try, you might really love it. I think Think Up House is one of my favorite games. It is by a designer by the name of Michael Breaux. And Michael Breaux, I think, has a very good claim on being the greatest living game designer. We don't really have big game designer, like high profile game designers, as much as you would think.
No.
Like we did for a while. I don't know, maybe I'm just slightly out of it. I mean, we sort of do.
No, really.
But for a while, we had people like Will Wright. You know, you have big personalities. For a while, they tried to make them like, oh, American McGee. We're going to turn him into like a person. But he really wasn't. I think in Japan, you see this more. You've got people like Kojima and Yoko Taro. And you know what I mean? Like there's a more of a culture of a known game designer who's appreciated as an auteur. And here, you know, we have people that we like, that we follow. But the idea of like a large figure, influential, whose work people kind of recognize as being like important and groundbreaking. I really think Michael Breaux kind of, for me and for a lot of my game designer buddies, actually, Michael Breaux really is that. He's super smart, original. Again, working in a kind of miniature mode. He makes very small games that are dense bundles of interlocking ideas that usually have something genuinely surprising and original about them mechanically, and then are extremely tightly designed to kind of support that central idea. In Think Up House, that central idea is that it's a tiny dungeon crawler. It's mostly kind of abstract. You're navigating through a series of procedurally generated rooms. And you have these five magic wands that you're using to survive, to deal with monsters that you encounter. And the central mechanic is that these five wands are, at the beginning of every game, they're procedurally generated. So each of them have a bunch of different properties, magic powers that they do that determine their function, but they're hidden to you. And you only discover them by using them. You discover what their properties are by using them. So it's taking this idea, the magic wand in NetHack, where you have to like, or a potion in NetHack, or a potion in Rogue, where you have to test it to learn what it does. And it really takes that and it explodes that as a core mechanic to a game, which is especially interesting because what happens is that you are suspended between two modes where you want to use the thing and get the most useful effect out of it, but you also want to learn about the thing. You're trying to balance this information management where you're learning what the thing does with the practical questions of surviving in this world and getting stuff done and killing monsters and getting treasure. It's a beautiful game. It takes that little idea, which is kind of about explore versus exploit a little bit. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Where you're both doing something in the world and you're learning about the world at the same time. Anyway, it's a brilliant example of one of the world's best game designers at his peak, and it's a perfect fit for the device. It's also as an iPhone game, it fits into your life, it fits into your schedule. Like it's one of those, it's a different kind of game in a way. Like I think what makes Michael Breaux's work challenging and difficult, it's not nearly as well known as he should be, and he's not nearly as successful as he should be. And part of it is that in Think Up House, every single turn you take matters. It's very unusual in games for this to be the case. Very unusual. Even in strategy games. Even in the brilliant strategy games that people love, Civilization or games like that, right? Tactics games that everyone loves. You realize, like, so many of the turns you take in those games.
There's a lot of crossing the map, isn't there?
Yeah, there's just a lot of walking around, you know.
Yeah.
And So in this game, in Psychopaths, and it's like, oh, it always matters. Everything you do matters in a way that is kind of like surprising. So in one sense, it's a really good fit for a game you play on the subway or when you're standing in line. But in another way,
you got to concentrate.
It's not, because it really does reward kind of full concentration at every moment, which is a surprising thing for any game to do.
Okay, Psychopaths. I reckon you've shifted a few copies of that, Frank. Well, time marches on, but I'd like to just quickly return to your story. So you're at Errorcode now, owned by Zynga, creator of Farmville. So then how soon did you then leave to move to NYU, and how did that happen?
So this is all kind of happening simultaneously, because I always had one foot in the industry as a developer and one foot in academia as someone who loved teaching game design. And so I was kind of doing both at the same time. And then, after Errorcode got acquired, that was right around when NYU got this big gift and wanted to start something about games and sort of asked me to be the person to kind of like figure out how to make a department around game design within NYU. And so they just kind of the timing lined up pretty well. And I started going from just teaching one class a semester to like figuring out how to create a whole curriculum and a whole department around that. So then that became more of a focus for me.
So maybe we could come to your fifth and your final game now, Frank. Can you tell us about it? It's from 2017 as well. What's the game and why do you love it?
So it's the game Everything by David O'Reilly. Just a weird, brilliant, creative person. He does
Irish artist, isn't he?
Yeah, he's an artist and an animator who had made an earlier game called Mountain. It's a little experimental game, very weird, kind of oblique game. I just kind of bounced off of it. I didn't really get Mountain, but then he made this PlayStation game, Everything, and it was, I mean, I just found it astonishing. It is so, everything is like, it's like the work of Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman in films. You know what I mean? Like, where they're doing something and you're like, oh, you can't do that in a movie. That's not how movies work.
Right, right.
Do you know what I mean?
I do, like,
being John Malkovich, right? Adaptation. What? Like, that's not how movies work. That's what Everything is like. And it's funny because David O'Reilly is like this kind of impish, perverse guy who wants to like play with conventions and turn things upside down and kind of put a thumb in the eye of your expectations and your predictions about how you're going to interact with this thing. But because of the way it is built around the voice of Alan Watts, this philosopher, this Zen Buddhist philosopher, everything is so sincere. Like, it is not ironic, it is not tongue-in-cheek, it is not a joke about transcendence or awakening or spirituality. It is an artist exploring an idea that is bigger than they are, and being 100% honest about it and following it where it goes, and using the material of a video game to explore what's possible in the world, to explore what the world is, to explore himself and his own way of thinking and encountering the world through the voice of Alan Watts. I can imagine people encountering this and just bouncing off of it. Like, I have no idea where to start with this, but For me, the opposite thing happened, which is I was drawn into this game.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
in a way that was really, really special.
Yeah,
and I played it wholeheartedly, and I remember playing it late at night, and being very tired and kind of like drifting off. And there's this thing that happens in everything where if you just stop pushing the buttons on the controller, it gently and slowly starts to play itself. It just like, if you just leave the controller, it will start like just making up its own inputs and continuing. And that, like, more than just being a clever idea or a gimmick, like that, I found that like deeply moving. Like it actually happened to me where it's late at night, I'm really tired, I'm playing this game, I'm kind of falling asleep, and I am listening to Alan Watts talk about how the self is a story that we make up because we're afraid. And I'm just like, I'm suspended in between playing this game and this game just playing itself. And I don't even know where I am anymore. Like, this is like, I loved it so much. I genuinely found it, yeah, profoundly, profoundly beautiful and profoundly moving. And it's like, and like Wipeout, back when I encountered that, I was like, okay, this is the kind of thing I want to make. And the fact that David O'Reilly is just out there making it, like getting, like finding the budget to get people to like help him make this strange, experimental, but very beautiful, very sincere kind of, you know, unique exploration of the meaning of software, right? The meaning of interactivity. There's nothing like it. I think of everything. Yeah, I'm not going to say it's the last great video game, because I think the last great video game is Disco Elysium. I think Disco Elysium was like, for me, the thing that like, it just felt like the end of an era somehow. I didn't put a Disco Elysium on my list because I don't think I want to play Disco Elysium again. I don't think I want it. Like, I would play everything. I can imagine being on a desert island and having this console that you've made me make, and just having everything on in the mix, I think is perfect. I'd go to it and just like experience.
Yeah, it's like a meditation. Whereas Disco Elysium is like the opposite of a meditation, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think of them in strange ways. I think of them as similar for some reason. I think they both represent there is something strange happening in games. I do think we are at a place where they are turning into something new. They're changing. I think we're going to see new kinds of games. Everything is the culmination of one era of video games. And yeah, I really love it.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's an incredible game. And I'm sort of mad that it wasn't more widely talked about perhaps at the time. But yeah, I'm so glad you put it on.
And yet, Simon, it was perfectly talked about.
Right.
Like because the world is the way it is. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that everything tells us, is that there is no other version of the world in which it was talked about more or talked about better or different. It's like there is nothing about it that can be any different. And that is beautiful.
Well, Frank, thank you. Thank you so much for this. So your games were Wipeout, Rhythm Tengoku, Galcon, Chinko Pouse, and Everything. That's a wonderful, wonderful console. We need a name for your console to market to the world. I can't remember if I gave you a heads up about this or not, but...
I didn't.
Oh, to put you on the spot a bit then, have you got a little a little brand name we can use for your console?
Let's call it the... maybe it's the... let's call it the Solution Machine.
Lovely. Very nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which ends perfectly with Everything, I think.
Yeah.
Well, this has been wonderful, Frank. Thank you. Thank you so much. And also just thank you for me for just all the amazing work you've done over the years and the way you've articulated things that are difficult to express about video games. And that's helped me. And I know it's helped many other people as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Simon. That's very sweet of you to say. I really appreciate it. And it's been a wonderful conversation. So thanks a lot for inviting me.
Frank, Lance, everyone, what a brilliant thinker and articulator of the unique charms and beauties of video games. And actually hearing him speak about Everything, I Loved Everything by David O. Reilly, who you should go and look up if you're not aware of him and his work. He did a really fantastic episode of the cartoon Adventure Time, just to give you an idea of the variety of work that David has produced. Anyhow, I played Everything back when it came out and absolutely loved it. I think I reviewed it for Eurogamer perhaps and put it on my New Yorker's Best Games of the Year list and all of that stuff, but I haven't been back to it. And hearing Frank talk about that, and especially with the music playing behind him, it's made me want to turn the lights down low in the middle of the night and fire up Everything again. So I'll be doing that this summer. Maybe you should too. I've actually subsequently as well downloaded two of the games that I hadn't played before on his list. So Galcon, there's a sequel to Galcon available on iOS, iPhone and iPad right now, Galcon 2. It's a really good game. I've been having a lot of fun playing that. And Syncopaus as well, by Michael Brow. I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to say that. Anyhow, I'm going to try and see if I can get Michael on here as well, because as Frank's calling him the greatest living, our greatest living game designer, why wouldn't we want to hear from him? So yes, I'll try and get hold of Michael and see if I can get him on here. Back to Frank anyhow. That was great, wasn't it? Frank has been blogging about games and writing about them and of course teaching them. I wish we could have got a bit more into his tenure at NYU, where he set up the game studies program and taught there for I think 12 years, so a significant amount of time, and he's still involved in some way. I'm not exactly sure how, but as you can hear from that, time was running out on us, and I don't want to, he'd already been very generous with his time, so I don't want to keep him for too long. If you want to hear more from Frank though, he has a book out this autumn to winter, so it's out on the 3rd of October 2023. It's called The Beauty of Games by Frank Lance. It's coming out with MIT Press, certainly in the US in October. I think it's out in the UK and English-speaking European areas as well. I'm not quite sure if it's getting translated and taken elsewhere, but certainly in October, if you are an English speaker and reader, then get hold of The Beauty of Games. You can also play Frank's most recent game, I think I mentioned it in the introduction there, called Babel Royale, which is a very cute spin on the Battle Royale phenomenon. Babel Royale is a version of Battle Royale, except you're making words as in Scrabble, and while the map gets smaller and smaller. Really fun. He made that with his son, James, who is also an accomplished game designer. Lots of Frank Lance content for you to go and enjoy. He's also on Twitter, of course. He is at FLANTZ, Flance, at Flance. So, yeah, go give Frank a follow. Listen, he's always worth listening to on games, for my money. One of the great thinkers and writers on games that we have. You can follow the podcast as well on Twitter if you're still there. I haven't set up on all the others yet. Let's see where the dust falls on all that stuff. But for now, on Twitter, at MyPerfectConsole, with the O's removed from console. You can also follow me on there, at Simon Parkin. If you'd like to become a supporter of the podcast, head to patreon.com/MyPerfectConsole for just $5 or £4.50 or whatever your local currency is a month, around that. You can get your episodes early and ad-free. You'll get access to the community. You'll get bonus episodes and lots of other things that go up on there. And there'll be more and more as time goes on, I'm sure. So yeah, it's also just a great way to show your support for the podcast. We've got a nice little community there. Come and join in. and then we'll keep making these for as long as we can. Yes, I'm not sure if I've mentioned this so far, but I'm very excited to say that at the live event, the My Perfect Concert Live, that's happening at WASD Festival, that's happening in September, we're ready to announce our guest for that. We'll have done a post on this or put it on social media, but if you haven't seen yet, then our guest for that is the brilliant David Wilson. David has had a long and very illustrious career, which we will talk about on stage during that episode. But perhaps most notably, he was director of communications for Sony PlayStation for no less than 19 years. From the launch of the PlayStation 2 in the year 2000 all the way up to 2019 and PlayStation 5. So that's a lot of ground to cover. We're going to be talking about all sorts of exciting moments in his career. Prior to that, he was head of European communications, I think, at EA all through the 90s during the FIFA and the Madden releases. And then even before that, in the late 80s and early 90s, he was working at Dennis Publishing, I think on Your Sinclair. So, yeah, if you're a bit longer in the tooth, then maybe you read his words at some of those magazines. Anyway, very exciting guest. And I've actually already met up with David just to talk about some of the things that we're going to be allowed to talk about on stage. And he is pretty willing to be pretty open, I'd say. So expect to talk about the Daily Mail doing a big story about goat sacrifice for the God of War 2 launch and his perspective on that. Get ready to talk about the Church of England kicking up a big stink about the Manchester Cathedral appearing in Resistance 2. And of course, lots of positive things as well. The great successes that Sony's had, as well as the crises that David has had to deal with. Along his brilliant career, he of course now works for NetEase Games, where he's looking after people like Suda51 and Nagoshi as well. So anyhow, it's going to be a really good time. Come along. It is happening at the WASD Festival. That is happening on Thursday, the 14th of September 2023 at 7 o'clock in the evening in London. Just search WASD and My Perfect Console and you'll come up with a link to buy a ticket. Any problems, drop me a line. I'm sure it'll be fine and we can help sort you out. Anyway, lots of exciting things to look forward to there. I hope you've been having a lovely summer as well. I'll be back again next week with another guest, their five games and one more Perfect Console.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.